Welcome to Absolutely Critical by Fortress, where leaders across government and industry share how they protect mission-critical systems in environments where disruption, compromise, or failure simply isn't an option.
Hey there, welcome to the Absolutely Critical podcast. I'm your host, Lee Mangold. Risk management isn't a topic that people are usually excited to talk about. For some, risk management really only happens when an auditor asks for your risk register. But for others, it's a fully developed and complex process. But the reality is we're doing risk management every day, whether we know it or not. Sometimes it's right, and sometimes it's not so right. So today we're gonna dive into the wonderful world of risk management and talk about some of the basics, but also really how to get started in your organization. To help us through that, I welcome our guest today, David White. David is the president and co-founder of Axio, where he advances cyber risk quantification and resilience across critical infrastructure sectors. He leads Axio's work with the U.S. Department of Energy and Cyber Risk Institute, and contributes to policy initiatives shaping the future of cyber oversight.
Thank you, Lee. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm excited to talk about risk management.
I know. We talked beforehand, and it's David and I met, and I was actually really excited to talk about risk management. I said it takes kind of a special kind of person to really get excited about risk management, but here we are, right? I think this is one of those topics that, you know, I don't think we talk enough about. You know, we hear about this, every audit that we do, everything that we do in cybersecurity and risk and compliance in general is all boils down at some point to risk management. Yeah.
It really does. In security, we are in fact managing risk all the time, but are we managing the right risks? Are we prioritizing the right risks? And are we managing them in a way that's most efficient and effective for the organization? And that's where the process, and I loved in the intro, Lee, that you called it a process, because risk management
it's a life cycle, right? So let's get started. Yeah. So when you hear the term risk management in a business context, you know, what should leaders really be thinking about? Risk management means different things to different people, but where do you see organizations, where should they start? And where do they seem to get things wrong?
Well, I think, so first, it is a process. So they should be thinking, this is a process. It's something to do, not something to buy. Now, there might be some tools that you buy to help you out with the process, but think process first. And remember the basics, because, you know, risk, like the dictionary definition is just exposure to danger, harm, or loss, right? So it's some exposure. And the objective of the risk management process is to keep that exposure within acceptable limits for the organization. And so now we've seen a couple of things. So it's a process. It's something I have to do, right? And what are these acceptable limits? Like, what are the limits? And that's where it connects with governance, with the C-suite and the board, because that's where those limits should come from, right? But, you know, then because it's a process, you need, and, you know, a process is just a machine. It's, you know, really, I like to think of a process as a machine. So we need a machine that's repeatable and efficient that we can afford to operate to identify risks, analyze risk, prioritize risk, and then treat those risks to get them, to get the whole portfolio of risk within that exposure limit, right? And that's really what to think about in this.
I think maybe the basic terms, you hit a lot of stuff there, right? I think there's this tendency to look at risk management from an all or nothing perspective too, right? It's about managing to an expectation, right? It's managing to your risk thresholds, and there's lots of ways to do that, right? Obviously, you know, one of the things that I've always been a really big advocate of, and we talked about this a little bit, we're going to fight a little bit, is, you know, I'm a big fan of qualitative risk management. Now I have a whole process to that, right? Which is different than I think some.
Okay.
But I have a whole process that I use for that. But you know, I think a lot of people are still are stuck in if they're doing something more than the auditor comes by and asks for your risk register. They're doing a stoplight chart, or they're doing low, medium, high. I think we can agree something's better than nothing, generally speaking.
Yeah.
But you know, I think my real question is, they're like, what do you think the limitations are to that kind of approach, kind of more specifically, as opposed to, well, I guess before, let's back up and define qualitative versus quantitative.
Well, qualitative is typically characterizing risks using a color scale, red, yellow, green, stoplight scale, t-shirt size, small, medium, large, like that, right? I think the icon of a qualitative risk management program is a 5x5 matrix that's red at the top and top right and green at the bottom left, and you scatter the risks across that playing field as a way to analyze them. The challenge is, and we agree,
yeah,
that it's a whole lot better than nothing, right? And it's also, for an organization just getting started and with building a risk management program, it's a reasonable place to start, right? It's also, look, some of my risk nerd friends make fun of me because I'm a big fan, even when you've moved to a quantitative program, I'm a big fan of using that 5x5 matrix as a consensus building tool and forget the absolute scales, right? Just forget the absolute scales. But if you're bringing a group of a team from your security program into a room and you've got like 20 risks identified and you need to do a quick triage, then having the team bucket them to say, you know, we don't know what the likelihood is, but this one here is more likely than that one, and that one's more likely than this one. So now we can start to sort them across relative likelihood and relative impact and use that to build consensus, and keep it in relative terms. I think it's a really valuable tool. I think where qualitative runs into problems is that it presents risk in a way that is, from my view, inconsistent with the language of business, right? So if you're a CISO and you're going into a board meeting to ask for a special allocation of $10 million because you've got this hair on fire risk,
right?
And so you're like, well, I've got this risk and it's red. Well,
yellow.
What will it be after we give you the 10 million?
It'll be a lighter
shade
of red now.
Be red, but
right,
maybe a little less red, right? And you know, that's where you run into problems. And then you've got a colleague coming in who is asking for 10 million for a special project that's going to add that he has a model suggesting will add $100 million in revenue to the bottom line, right? Which of you is going to get the funding? The guy who marched in with the crayon, or the guy who
marched in with the
spreadsheet?
Yeah, you know, I think there's one of my approaches that I've kind of done with this a lot is, even though it's very qualitative in nature, I agree with you. I think it's beautiful to kind of see that chart. And you're right, the consensus building thing, I've never really thought about it in those terms. And that's, I think, the allure to a lot of this, or a lot of the qualitative, is you can just see really quickly and you can kind of make a quick judgment. I think a lot of value in that. One of the things that I've done a lot is, when I do those risk judgments, I actually do have some qualitative or quantitative measures on there. And they're higher level thresholds, right? But if it's over this kind of a value potential, right, then it's going to be high, or it's going to be a critical or very high, whatever we call it. I think there's ways to mix that. But yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, one of the things that I've always kind of run into, and there's lots of models out there for everything, right? But one of the things I've always run into is this idea that, you know, quantitative approaches can be really complicated, and they can be very complex. You know, how do you overcome that? I mean, well, first of all, do you agree? And how do you kind of overcome that?
Well, they can be they can be complicated. And, you know, frankly, there are, I think risk quantification in has earned a bad name, has earned a bad reputation for being complicated by forgetting to keep it simple and forgetting to use it for as a decision-making tool, not as quantification for quantification's
sake. That makes
sense, yeah. Right? And so, because when you're, you can, you know, when it's a decision-making tool, then you can stop when you've got enough insight to make the right decision, right? When it's quantification for quantification's sake, you can spend weeks, months refining those probability estimates or gathering more data for those probability estimates. So, but, you know, I promise you, you don't need probability to, you know, three digits right of the decimal point to use it as a decision-making tool, right? And if that's where you're focused, you're gonna exhaust yourself, right?
Right.
Without generating value. Same on the impact side, right? I mean, you know, look, I did a risk quantification study for a company. Maybe, oh God, it's been 7 or 10 years ago, and we had a group of experts around a boardroom table and made some impact estimates, threw some impact estimates on a spreadsheet, and then they were like. Well, that's really big. We've got to refine that number because it's so big. Well, how about it's so big? We know it's a big number. Let's implement a control to bring that risk under control. Well, no, they wanted to. So they spent 6 months, commissioned a study, did a data pull from every manufacturing location around the globe and like assembled all this data. And after 6 months of study, the impact number changed by less than 10%. But at the end of the day, on day one, we knew it was a big number worth doing something about, right? Is a 10% variance in that number really worth it, right? So that's where, you know, that aiming, like, perfection is the enemy of good enough, right? That saying, right? We've got to keep we've got to keep it good enough. Don't aim for perfection. Keep it simple and remember that this is about making a decision. So it's not about, you know, risk navel gazing.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I mean, my follow-up question to that was there's always that pushback of we don't have enough information. Right. And you're right. It's so funny. It's the decimal precision doesn't really matter in this kind of realm. Right. And the farther down the path you go on that, the more complicated you make it, right? And I guess one of the questions that I kind of have that kind of dovetails on that is, you know, how I think a lot of companies, a lot of organizations struggle with that risk register sort of view and kind of understand, like, you can have, if you measure every risk possible, how do you manage anything? Right. What are you kind of your strategies, your approach to determining what to measure or what risk to handle?
I'm an advocate of having some constraints on the risk register personally. Like a new risk needs to earn its space, so to speak, right?
Okay. Yeah. I agree.
I've seen a couple of interesting ways to deal with that. Well, I've also seen, like, a bloated risk register is a really big problem. And I've seen risk management programs fail because of risk register bloat, right? We've got 1,200 risks on the risk register. You've got what? Like,
how many? Exactly. That's always the question. Well, how often do you review those?
We just keep adding. We don't go back and review anything, right? I worked with one organization and they had, when they first created the risk register, they gave it, I forget how many slots. Let's see. They gave it 15 slots. We're going to track no more than 15 risks. Right. Mm. And only when they identify something that, after some analysis, is clearly not some variation or sub risk of one of those other risks, will they expand the slot? So they've got governance around the risk register, which I'm a fan of because it's the only way to keep it manageable. Mm-hmm. Go back to my machine analogy. Risk management is building machine. You've got to build a machine that you can afford to operate. I haven't met anybody who can afford to operate a risk management machine that can keep up with 1,200 risks on the risk register, right? That's okay. And I also saw one time that had, they had grown from a 5x5 matrix to a 15x15. And that was nightmarish too, right? Yeah,
that's almost back to that decimal precision problem, right? Of like, did it really matter? It's still red. It's just a little bit lighter shade, right? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of interesting because, you know, you've all been in those conversations where, you know, somebody will use the phrase, and I've used the phrase like, hey, we need to track that as a risk, or hey, we need to track on that. Right. And that's not necessarily always something you want to add to the risk register. You know, I always think of it as sort of the pain in the future of having to update and manage that. And I think if people sort of realize that once it's on the register, you become accountable for actually reviewing it and making sure it's updated. Once they realize that, they might change their view on how many things they want to throw on that risk register. But yeah, no, I agree though. I think it really does come from, you have to really think through that governance process and how you're going to do that.
You know, I think, Phil Venables, famous quote from Phil Venables years ago when he was CISO at Goldman Sachs, he said, if quantifying the risk costs more than buying the control to mitigate the risk, just buy the damn control. Sorry, I said a bad word, but it was in the context of a quote.
Control.
You know, that's part of the governance rails that you want around a risk management program. Risk needs to earn that. It needs to earn the oxygen it takes to put it on that risk register.
I love that phrase. You know, the risk needs to earn its way on the risk register. I think that's really important. I think there's also possibly the inverse of that too. Yes. Of just because you don't want to track the risk doesn't mean it doesn't need to be on the register. But yeah, I think it's really interesting. And thinking about, you know, I mean, how often are you going to review your risk register? How much time will it take you to review those items? And I think in a lot of cases, you kind of back your way into, you know, hey, we can't exceed more than X number of things.
And a lot of them, when you see that bloat, there's so many that like, put them in buckets, right? They're like, you know, find... Do an affinity analysis and get that risk register condensed into categories of risk and manage at that level, right? And then you can have categories and exemplars of risk, right? That's another approach.
And you know, to that point, there was, you know, I was having a conversation with somebody the other day, and we were talking about, you know, TPRM, third party risk. You've got hundreds, thousands of vendors, right? And you can assign a risk rank, a risk score to each of those vendors. But just because the vendor is listed there as high doesn't mean it goes on your official risk register, right? It gets bucketed into something else. And that's where I think people get very confused about this. And it just becomes overwhelming.
Yeah, I think that would be a really bad move to put every vendor in every high risk vendor, right?
Yeah. Well, Where does that end, right? You had an assessment done, and they came back with critical findings. Does that every critical finding go on the register? No, there's a lot of other ways you can bucket that. Yeah, no, I'm completely on board there. I think that is an interesting thing that I've actually very recently noticed in some conversations that I've had in the last, we'll say, 3 weeks, where I've had this conversation two or three times with different folks in different areas, where it looks so overwhelming because they got, what happens when my Tenable scans and I've got all these vulnerabilities, like that doesn't go on your risk register. It always turns around to, well, then what does go on the risk register? And I think it's a very interesting thought experiment that like, and the risk of all those scans is you've got unknown, right. You've got vulnerabilities in your
exactly.
production environment that could lead to
a vulnerability is not a risk.
Right.
A vulnerability is a weakness.
Right.
Weaknesses may
right.
cause risk probability to go up or risk impact to go up, but they are not risks, right? The risk might be we have a vulnerability right. in our manufacturing right. environment, and the risk of that is that it could lead to a shutdown if it was compromised in the following way. Well, is there a pathway whereby it could be compromised in that way, right? Well, if there is, then yeah. you have a risk from that vulnerability. And yeah, you ought to do something about it. But if that conversation cost more than it would to just go right. in there and patch it, and there's a patch available and you can deploy right. it, then you know what I would do.
Yeah. Let's not yeah. spend the time on talking about it. Do it, right? Yeah. Yeah. I think it's you know, that down that vulnerability chain of like, it's not... It is a matter of, well, why didn't you fix it? Why wasn't it patched already? Why did that happen? And you can always tease out it's root cause analysis at some point, right? But what was the reason yeah. that vulnerability revealed itself? I think it's really interesting.
Now,
and, you know, do you not have enough people?
Yeah, to do and your vulnerability? Not having enough people to manage vulnerabilities, that could mm-hmm. be a risk. That could lead to a risk. That, in fact, yeah. that in itself is
right.
a vulnerability. Because it's a weakness in your program, right? And it's
right.
it could lead to a variety of risks as the sort of source point, right? Now, I don't want any of your listeners sure. to take away an idea that vulnerability management is not important. Vulnerability management is extremely important,
right.
and I would argue it's becoming more and more important because there are threat groups out there that are mechanizing the exploit of vulnerabilities as soon as they reveal themselves by a patch being made available, right? And so, you know, I hear people talking about instead of a 0 day, they're talking about 1 day vulnerabilities,
yeah.
right? And so, yeah, that vulnerability management is very important. But let's not conflate vulnerabilities with risks. That's
right.
a trap.
Yeah. That's a really, really great point. And yeah, like I said, I've had that conversation a lot lately, and it really, I've been waiting to ask you that and kind of, yeah. So you kind of talked about this a little bit, you know, when you have the, you know, risk conversations often tend to struggle with boards, with, you know, when you're competing for those priorities, for those budgets,
yeah.
you know, how does quantitative risk change
it's a
the
game
way
changer.
that you approach those conversations?
And I just recorded a video with Phil Venables. So I've got Phil Venables on the mind. I'm a big fan of Phil's. And, you know, Phil has written a lot about the evolution of the CISO role. And he talks about CISO 2.0 being CISO as an executive, as the chief digital mm-hmm. risk officer, as the CEO of the security program. And so... to evolve our
right.
evolve into that role requires that we mm-hmm. take on the actions and mannerisms of a business executive. And the language of business is dollars, right? Or financial terms, I should say. And so we have to learn to talk about what we're doing in those terms, to justify what
right.
we're doing in those terms, to justify decisions
right.
and priorities we're making in those terms. And to do that, we've got to embrace quantitative risk management. It is a game changer. And I've had CISOs, I know a lot of CISOs who are using it very effectively in their board communications to the benefit of their program. There's a lot of conversation about resilience in the security world these days. And you know, think about the bottom line on resilience, because for an organization's, the bottom line on an organization's resilience is financial, because if that organization has the financial wherewithal to make it through an event and live to fight another day, then it has demonstrated resilience, right? And so we've got to understand those resilience limits in financial terms. Like how much, if, because, you know, you look like, you look at an event like what just happened with Jaguar Land Rover, that was an event that tested the economic resilience of an entire industry sector in the UK, right? I mean, that was a big one, right? Understanding those, like, and talk about governance, that's governance at the macro level, right? Maybe we should do some risk management there too to understand like what could go wrong that brings an entire industry and our economy down, right? Maybe that's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, we'll start with baby steps, Dave. Baby steps. you know, I think for me, because I try to contextualize this into, for me anyways, into how I can, you know, you always try to do something a little bit better tomorrow, right? And one of the strategies that I've always done, and I've always been an advocate of, was, you know, my methods have never been purely like a qualitative risk management. There's always been some quantitative approach to it because of exactly what you said, right? Of, you know, you have to, if you can't speak in actual probabilistic terms and show the money, it's really hard to say, well, how much do you need to mitigate that risk, right? If you're not coming to the table with that, and it doesn't, you know, what exactly are you asking for, right? I guess I'll ask you a very loaded question, which I did not prepare you for.
Okay.
There's lots of risk methodologies and frameworks out there. What are your favorites?
Well, my favorite is the one that we created at Axio. That's my favorite. risk quantification experts that are friends of mine that know our methodology have described as kind of a mashup of some other methods, FAIR among them, but you know, it's a mashup. But really what we've tried to do at Axio is make risk quantification accessible, democratize it, make it easy enough to get started that you can actually succeed in building a quantification-based risk management program. And I think we've succeeded. And look I have very strong opinions about how to get started.
And that's my next question. I get there, but I think there's it is always interesting when you, I did a presentation for a B-Sides event, I guess about a year ago. We were talking GRC in general, and obviously the R, right, in GRC. And I had a slide up of, I want to say it's probably 16 or 18 different risk assessment methodologies, risk assessment approaches. And I kid you not, within 3 seconds, somebody asked, hey, what about, and I don't even remember what he asked about. And then somebody else on the other side of the room, well, what about this? And we're like, if I make the font any smaller, you can't read it, right? Like, it's so funny because it's like you just lit a match in the middle of the room about somebody's favorite method to do something. And I think, and this is kind of what you've been really hitting on, is at the end of the day, we have to figure out what is actually important to the business and what's going to work for me and what's going to work for our environment.
Exactly. I was just going to say, Lee, that, you know, I can say with absolute certainty that the right methodology for you is the one that you will use.
Yeah, 100%. Right. 100%. Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, that's I think to me is sort of that biggest allure to the qualitative risk management is if you're going to do it, just do it. Just do something.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe next year we're going to migrate and make it better. Yeah.
I would argue, Lee, that you're actually doing quantitative risk management. But you're displaying the output on a risk matrix, because if you're actually putting dollar thresholds on the impact scale, then you've stepped into quant land, my friend.
I don't
welcome to the club.
I don't,
wanna,
Let's not put words in my mouth here. That's not good for an argument. Yeah, no, that's yeah, and I think that's probably largely why it's worked for me. Is, I mean, I have to know. It's the analytical brain, right? I have to know, like, well, why did I call this a high risk, right? Like,
exactly.
How can I defend it as a high risk, right? Yeah, I think that's all right. You might be right. So let me ask you, and that kind of really dovetails into one of our final questions here. So, you know, organizations who want to move either to risk management in general, small or large, whatever they may be, or even moving into quantitative risk management, what's a realistic first step for these organizations that, you know, isn't going to overwhelm their team or result in a complete overhaul on day one, right?
Yeah. First of all, don't do an overhaul on day one. Definitely don't do that. Definitely don't do that. That's akin to stepping on a landmine, right? Don't do that. Start simple. The thing that I've been advocating recently is, look, you're probably already doing tabletop exercises occasionally, hopefully more than annually, right? But you're doing something to, like, polish your preparedness saw, right? And at your next tabletop exercise, have somebody there whose job it is to keep a running tally of how much this event has cost the organization in expenses that you hadn't planned for and revenue that you failed to earn as a result of the event because you have a business interruption, okay? Right. And precision is, again, this is not about precision. Right, ranges. Right. And those ranges could be uncalibrated and incredibly wide. Like, what are we going to spend on? Are we going to bring in forensics for this? Well, do we have a retainer? Do we know what that's going to cost? Oh, well, let me consult the Google, right, machine and see if I can get a quick estimate of what a forensics firm is going to cost per hour. How many hours do you think they'll be here? And how many folks do you think will be here? Well, I can do some simple math and say, oh, well, now I think forensics is going to cost between $50,000 and $250,000, right? Like, now, okay, fine. And at the end of the tabletop, you'll have an estimate of impact for that event. And now you've changed the conversation because you've gotten everybody in the room thinking not just about getting things back to normal operating condition, but also what the business impact has been. You've started the journey for everybody at that tabletop to become a business-minded security person on their pathway to CISO 2.0.
Yeah, no, that's a really cool idea. I've never really thought about that. Unfortunately, my team will be doing that on our next tabletop. I think it's a really, really interesting idea. And, you know, I think also there's a point there of bringing folks into that tabletop exercise that may not have been in that exercise to begin with.
Right.
You know, you got people who may be in risk and compliance, but you've been doing a security operations tabletop. Right.
Well, think of the conversations that can spawn in the organization. Because if you can't come up with a quick estimate, then take an action item to go and talk to the folks in finance and say, hey, suppose hypothetically that we had to shut down this operation for 5 days. What would the financial impact of that be? Like, how much revenue would we lose? How many customers would we lose? You know, what would that, now you've built a bridge in understanding cyber risk across the organization that wasn't there before through one conversation, right?
Yeah, that's the big takeaway for me for this one. That's a really great idea. You know, I'm kind of pulling that thread of, it's always, we are, you know, on the technical side, right? We're interested in, well, what are our SLAs on this service? Yes. And it's very easy to say, okay, well, the SLA is this many dollars per, like, you can get that information, but the piece of it that is really easy to overlook, or on the other side, really easy to overestimate, is reputational harm, right? You may not, you may write your customers a check and say, hey, sorry, we were down for 3 days. But that also may mean you don't get renewal.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And the security operations team isn't going to know that. I think
that's exactly. But somebody in the organization will, and they'll also know exactly which competitors are going to pick up those customers.
Right. Well, David, you have given me, it will be your fault when more people get dragged into my next tabletop. I will make sure to give them your name and home address.
I'll be watching for packages.
Well, listen, Dave, this has been awesome. I really appreciate your time here. Big thanks to Dave White for joining us. David, where can people find you and your company online?
The best way to find me online is on LinkedIn. My LinkedIn handle is dwhite-axio, dwhite-axio, AXIO. That's the name of my company. You can find us at axio.com, AXIO.com. We'd love to show you what we can help you do.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, David. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
But that's it for this episode of Absolutely Critical Podcast. If you enjoyed this conversation, subscribe, share it with others, and we'll see you next time. Take care. Bye-bye.